Let's have an AA meeting. Hi, my name is Misty, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Books of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual, in our own personal stories, describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them, and I must have this thing too. And I'm really excited to introduce tonight's speaker. Her name is Donna, and she comes all the way from Think It Through here at NABA. Welcome, Miss Donna. Hi, everybody. I'm Donna, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Lisa for inviting me. And for everyone who does all the work behind the scenes and works so hard to keep this meeting going, this fellow here has been doing it for so many years. Yeah, clap for him. I spent 2 days with sleepless nights worrying about this because I haven't done this in a long time. I was just getting all upset and afraid, and then I thought, well, why don't I do something, unusual? Why don't I just turn it over? I think I let go and let God, something like that. So that's what I'm doing. I have no idea, except that I'm going to talk about my story. You know, my story doesn't, if you're new, or you're just trying to decide if you're, you belong here, if you have questions about it, and you hear my story and it's different from yours, just remember to look for the similarities rather than the differences from speakers in the program. And if you're an alcoholic, eventually you'll find somebody that you identify with. And that's what happened with me. I got sober May the 8th, 1976. Mm-hmm. And for that, I'm truly grateful. And I think one of the things why I was afraid is because I've got all these years and I think I should be something special, it's like, oh my God. But what I am is I'm extremely grateful because I'm sober because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is such a big part of that. It's not because of anything special about me, except that when I got to AA, I had hit a bottom that was great enough and hard enough and sad and miserable enough that I was willing to do anything to try to survive because I was about to die. I grew up in Atlanta and I lived for my family was Southern Baptist. We went to church all the time. I was like very shy, very religious. I wanted to be, a good little Christian girl. And I kept being, the preacher would always say, if you sin, you're going to hell. And I kept sinning. And it was like, it scared me to death, so I was like always trying to be good, but I would be mean to my sisters or something, I had this temper that I just decided that it was everybody else's fault if I got mad, and I was so shy, it was so hard for me to be to have friends and to be social that my early years were just very, very painful in school, and by the time I got to high school I was able to do some things. I was interested in art and poetry and music and not math and sports. So I got through that way. But by the time I was 15, we had my mother had remarried and we moved to Sandy Springs, and so we changed high schools. I was at Sandy Springs High School, and I just couldn't adjust. I couldn't adjust to the people. I felt so self-conscious all the time. And there's something that in the big book, it talks, the third step prayer is, relieve me of the bondage of self. Well, I didn't know what that meant, but now, you know, that's what that meant. I was in the bondage of self. And I discovered alcohol. I was 15, and a new girl came to town, and we'd sit in her, she had a car, and we'd go drag racing. And I'd lived this little, sweet, narrow life. And we went to her house, and her parents had booze, and they gave me a Southern Comfort highball. And they said, chug a lug, which I didn't even know what that meant, but I did. And I got drunk. And I guess I got up on the ping pong table and broke it. Woke up on the floor. I had passed out. It's lucky I didn't die, actually. I passed out, and I had blacked out, and everybody told me how much fun I was. It was like the first time I'd been, hey, I can be social. I can, you know, people will like me. And so and I've said this, people have heard me say this always, I believe I was alcoholic from the first drink. I was alcoholic before I had it. But then I had the obsession to get alcohol from that first drink and figure out, because I was underage, my family didn't have alcohol in the house, I had to figure out ways to get alcohol, and I managed to do it pretty well. I had this friend, Janie, and we used to, her parents had booze in the house, and she'd get a flask, and we'd skip school, and I'd been a really good student, but once I started drinking, that was a priority. And we'd go up to Arlington Cemetery and get drunk during school. Dead men tell no tales. So anyway, I just was, you know, that was my preoccupation. Atlanta had a lot of nightclubs. I met men that I married when I was 15 as well. He was a Georgia Tech student. He was studying physics and math. And we drank together. We drank a lot. And so my drinking, I just loved to be drunk. That was my whole purpose. It was like to get drunk. And at a certain point, it was like I graduated from high school, and I decided that I went to see this movie, The Days of Wine and Roses, and I came out thinking, I think I'm a potential alcoholic. But I knew that I hadn't been in a gutter on the street, and if anybody's seen in that movie, I hadn't crashed up any, you know, what is it, gardens or anything, see, my memory, oh well. But, so I just put that out of my mind. I left home at, right after high school, and married my boyfriend that I'd met, and we spent the next years just trying to control our drinking, and he was really a lot better at it than I was. You know, I couldn't get it. He also was good at quitting smoking. He started doing poorly at Georgia Tech, so he decided to join the Marines. And that was in the 60s. It's not really the time you want to be in the Marines. But anyway, by 1960, I think it was 1969, the summer of 69, he got sent to Vietnam. And he and I had, we'd done the whole thing from the chapter 3 in the big book of like trying to control our drinking by not keeping it in the house or not drinking at parties or by, you know, swearing off and doing all these other things. And we had done fairly well. But when he left, my drinking went out of control. So I was out like, what is it, like, worrying about him so much, I was in clubs every night drinking and getting drunk. And that really, from August of 1969, by January of 1970, January 15th, I had started taking Secanol with alcohol. So I was pretty loaded all the time. I was driving like that. And I took an overdose of Secanol. And that landed me in the hospital, tied down to a bed and in a ward, and a series of like psychiatrists and therapy and drugs to keep me from killing myself. And so my husband came home from Vietnam, and who knows, maybe that saved his life because he'd been on the front line. But we went through a period of years where, I was trying to get help. I was trying to get treatment. And, but there was no thought of alcoholism, no thought of AA. By 19, we ended up having two children. I had a baby son, his name was Tony, and my older son was Alan, and Alan was born with brain damage, and he was autistic and had cerebral palsy. And so I was totally unequipped to be taking care of this child, so it was very, very stressful, and I was, I was like just trying to hold it together. And by 1972, my husband got transferred to the West Coast, to San Diego, and because my son could get better schools there. And they had some great ones. I mean, he got great physical and occupational therapy and got to go camping in Big Sur and things like that. So he was in some good schools. But I had thought, in the back of my mind, that if we could get to California, because we weren't hanging out with people who were smoking dope or anything like that. We were, living the military kind of life. And I thought if we get out there, I could get marijuana, because I'd heard if you smoke marijuana, it's not addictive. And so that's how I could control my drinking. And so I started, by the time we got there in 72, by 73, I was divorced. And I had a Navy jet pilot boyfriend, and he taught me how to smoke dope and take speed and, various other things. And I became a hippie. And that could have been fun if I wasn't an alcoholic. But it became a disaster. So in the summer of 73, my youngest son, I had decided that I was going to leave this boyfriend, his name was Bill, and I was going to go straight. I was going to clean up, and everything was going to be fine. So I moved into this little cottage and had a swimming pool in the backyard. And I'd been there about a week. And my little son fell into the pool and drowned. And I don't usually talk about this because it's still really hard to talk about. But from that time until I got to the program, it just became a living, screaming hell for me. I stopped caring about trying to control my drinking. I was working at a bar, and I think the only reason I tried to control drinking was so I could keep my job in the bar, because they didn't really like me spilling drinks on people and wandering around saying, "Did you order a beer?" And not being able to remember what I was doing. And finally, I had this really close girlfriend, and she was worked in the bar with me, but she had known me when I had my son, when Tony was alive, and she got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew she had a problem with drinking, but but I thought that I was just crazy, and I thought I was just sick, and I thought that alcohol was the way that I survived. You know, that was what made me feel okay, was alcohol, and then combining it with the other things that I did, which back then, you know, it was magic mushrooms and quaaludes and all the other things. So I was pretty much out of it all the time. As a matter of fact, at the end of my drinking, I thought my vacuum cleaner talked to me. And I think I was about 6 months sober before I realized that it didn't. But I don't remember what it said. But anyway, so she got sober, and she didn't want anything to do with me anymore. And I had a phone full of names of people, and I just felt like there was nobody that really cared about me. And I had moved, you know, all those miles away from home and family, and they didn't know what to think of me because they, you know, they couldn't get in contact with me. They were worried about me all the time. You know, I just, like, was completely irresponsible. And so, anyway, she sent some people to come and do a 12-step call with me, and they came to my apartment, and you know, and I remember thinking they were way across the room because I was smoking dope, and I think they were just trying to stay away from me. But I remember there was something different about them. There was just, you know, I think that it was really the feeling that I couldn't manipulate them, you know, because that was kind of how I lived. And I decided that I would go to an AA meeting, and I would do it for research because I'd write a book. So it was pretty crazy, but anyway, I wandered into an AA meeting, and this story, I think I need to tell a little story that I heard from a speaker early in AA to really explain this one, because it's a story about this guy. I think his name was Tony, and he goes into a bar in Alaska, and the bartender is talking to this other man, and they say they're talking about God. And so Tony goes in there, and he says, "Well, I don't believe in God." And so they say, "Well, why?" And he says, "Because I was out in the tundra, you know, I was out in the blizzard, and I couldn't see where to go, and I knew I was going to die, and I fell on my knees, and I looked up at the sky, and I said, 'God, save me. You've got to save me. I'm going to die.'" And so they said, "Well, why don't you believe in God? You're here." And he said, "Because some goddamn Eskimo came and saved me." And the reason I tell that story is because when I went to that meeting, an Eskimo saved me. And I think I hadn't said, but right before I got to that meeting, I'm not sure exactly when it was, but I had gotten on my knees, and I had thought that I was writing a letter to my dad, you know, but instead I was writing to the higher power, and I never really knew my dad, but I just said, "I'm lost, I don't know what to do, I need help." And I had never done that before. I always could find some other answer. Well, it's a religion. Well, it's a change. Move here, move there. Do this, do that. I could always get some kind of therapy, something. I had no more answers. And I really had at the point where I was going to kill myself. So I had said that prayer, and then I don't know how the timing was, but that's when I wandered into that AA meeting. And I really think that, you know, that surrender. This man came up to me, his name was Ralph, and actually we called people by nicknames. His nickname at AA was Rotten Ralph, but he wasn't rotten. But anyway, he came up and asked me for a date, and so he was my escort, because what happened was my mind was too blown. I wouldn't have been able to get myself to meetings. And he drove me to meetings. And, you know, we got in a relationship, and he had two daughters, and so we had the kids. And he started taking me to meetings all over San Diego County. There was, like, meetings in the mountains and by the beach and, you know, by the, just camping out. All these really fun things to do. And I, eventually, he never said anything. He never said, "You're an alcoholic." So I would still drink when he was around. But going to the meetings and everything, I started to kind of soak in that maybe I was an alcoholic. Like I had thought so many years ago. You know, maybe I was an alcoholic. But how could I fit with these steps and what the program was saying about alcoholics? Did I fit? And so by having that help, when I finally admitted that maybe I was an alcoholic, it was like he helped me get a sponsor, and she got me into the steps, and I started going to meetings. They said go to a meeting a day for 90 days. And if you don't think you fit, you know, you don't want the program, we'll cheerfully refund your misery. And so my plan had been, okay, I'll try it for 90 days. If it doesn't work, I'll kill myself. So that was still part of the plan. I had the death plan. And yet, by 90 days, I had, you know, I was like, it was the most amazing thing. We were at a camp out, and I got my 90-day chip, and the kids were there, and all, you know, it was an AA camp out, and we were sitting by the fireside, and I thought, I don't believe it. I just don't believe it. I feel so different. And I had gotten right into the steps, and these things, to me, when the higher power takes over, it's like all kinds of things fall into place that you wouldn't imagine. And Ralph had never done a fourth step. He had 4 years. He'd never done past the third step, and then he did the 12th step. But he started, because I had done my fourth step, he started working the steps. And we took the kids. The kids went to Alateen, and we went to AA and Al-Anon, and then he used to say the dog, even the dog went to Al-A-Dog. And we started doing 12-step calls, and we had drunks, you know, getting sober on the couch, going to DTs, and we'd go to, you know, all these wet 12-step calls. And there was this one woman that she had called central office, and we couldn't get into her house. We finally got into her house, but she was laying in the bed, and her wrist had been slit, and the blood was dried on the bed. And so, you know, we took her to the hospital and everything, and that woman, well, she had this bird, and she said, "I want you to take care of my bird." And of course, the poor bird was dead, but but she survived, and she got sober. And we had other people, you know, getting sober in our house, and it was an incredible experience. And I started going to AA all the time, and because I was with him, I could go to meetings. Like I went to, you know, one or two, three meetings a day, and I kept up meetings every day for 4 years. And then I decided that I wanted to move on and leave him. So I remember, first I married him. I forgot to add that. So, you know, because everybody knows the story, but I married the first man I met in AA. But after about 3.5-4 years, I decided that I wanted a divorce and I wanted to go out on my own. And so I did, and got an apartment, and He ended up doing very well. He found a wonderful woman, and they got married and had a ranch outside San Diego, and, you know, worked out really well for him. But anyway, so I go into this apartment, and I'm thinking, well, why don't I have any sponsees? You know, I really need sponsees. And my sponsor says, well, you'll get sponsees when you have something to give. Okay. So, but they came. You know, when I had moved into that apartment, all of a sudden the phone started to ring. And so that helped keep me going. Now, when I worked my four step, the interesting thing is I was so out of touch with my feelings that I did not know I was resentful. I mean, I knew I hated my mother and my stepfather. That was clear. But other than that, I just felt guilty about everything. It's like, I'm guilty, I'm ashamed. I'm watching the time here. But I felt, it was like I did my four step using the columns just like the book says. But I just wrote, I feel guilty about, except for the hate part. And then I did it just like the book says. And what I did was I wanted to be like a really good student of AA, because it's like sober, I just needed to be, you know, like rocketed into the fourth dimension. So I was like sitting in the front row and, you know, studying the big book. And so I made all these lists of, like, what are the definitions for each defective character that's listed. And then I just that's how I did my four step. And then I thought, well, I knew so much that I would help Central Office in New York, because they would love to see my definition list. So back then we had to write letters. So I wrote them a letter. There was no email. Long-distance phone calls were too expensive. So I sent them my list of all these definitions and everything, and then waited for them to praise me and tell me how wonderful I was. And they wrote me back, and they said, well, this is very, you know, thank you for sending your suggestions and everything. However, you know, we think that everybody needs to find out how to work the program in their own way, you know. But that list really helped me, because those definitions I used, it helped to break through with me. It was like I didn't really know how I felt about anything. So when I got sober, and my husband was like, did something I didn't like, and I remember one day I just imagined breaking all the windows out in my house. And it was like, I think I'm angry. I mean, I was like totally out of touch. Alcohol had helped me completely hide my feelings from myself. And everything was everybody else's fault, God's fault. You know, it's like the world. I was the victim. And when I got sober, and I was sober long enough without a drink, I was just like, I have all these feelings, and, you know, I think I'm a really pissed off person. And so I started doing 10 steps every day, and the kids would, they were all diagnosed with some kind of mental disorder or whatever, you know, like my son, of course, we had autism, but the two girls, they were like, we had a foster son, he had paranoid schizophrenia, and then our one girl had antisocial personality, and the other one had childhood schizophrenia. So it was kind of like, it was like a, you know, happy madhouse. But we had all these good things. I mean, we went on trips and all this stuff. But I started writing all these inventories. So as soon as I would get up in the morning, my feet would hit the floor, I would be resentful about something. And so it's like they, you know, mess up the kitchen or whatever. So I would write all these inventories, and then I started to see this magical thing. It was like, this is how I really feel. You know, it feels like a freedom. Because in the program, it doesn't say that we're bad because we have defects of character. you know, we list these, we see these about ourselves, it says that we are powerless over them. And that, you know, the important thing is to be able to be honest with ourselves. It's not like I didn't come to AA and be told that I had to get good. What I found out was that I needed to be honest with myself so I'd know how I felt, because when all this resentment and all the fear, all the other things would rise up in me, then I would drink again. You know, that would send me back to drinking, and for me to drink was to die. So I wrote all the inventories, and I started seeing this magical thing like, I'm resentful at them because blah, blah, blah. And then over in the column about where I'm at fault, because I used the grid. I had this sponsor who used to say, oh, okay, we've got to take it to the grid again. But anyway, and then I'd see that I actually had the same defects of character that I was mad at them for or upset with them about. And I started seeing, you know, my true nature, and frankly, it was freedom. It really was a freedom, because not only did I have the seeing this about myself and understanding that my feelings weren't just this bald mess where, oh, I've got to go kill myself. It was, these are defects of character, and then I can go to step 6 and 7 and I can ask the higher power, I can get willing to let them go and ask the higher power to remove them, and that I don't have the power to remove them myself. That was not in my childhood, you know, church upbringing. It was like, you're supposed to do this yourself. You've got to be good yourself. And this, it was like, if you could remove your own defects of character, you wouldn't be an AA. You know, you wouldn't be an alcoholic. You wouldn't need AA. So I found a freedom in that, because for one thing, not only did we have 6 and 7, you know, but it it actually worked if I would ask the higher power to remove the defects of character. So, they're not all gone, you know. I mean, it's not like they go away and you're like a saint. I still have to do my inventory. I still get resentments. I found out I get pissed. I hold grudges. And I have to, you know, if people do things that I think are hurting me, then I'm gonna be mad about it. But that'll kill me if I hang on to it. And so I have to take it to the higher power and get willing to let it go. About when I was sober, I moved to Atlanta about 19. When was it? 70. When was it? 19. I moved to California in 72, so it was 92. So I came here. I brought my son because we were losing funding for him on the West Coast. And so I moved back to where family was. He got very sick right after I moved here, and I didn't really get established in AA when I got here. I think I came to this meeting like once, and I didn't like the people. I never liked the people, you know. Back from the beginning, I wouldn't like the people until they just, like, you know, I fell in love with them. So he got really sick, and he was hospitalized and in and out of the hospital, and he passed away. And when he died, I died. It was like, I thought that if I was a good girl in AA, and, you know, I worked the program, that this would never happen. You know, that what had happened to Tony would never happen again. I just stopped going to meetings because I blamed God. It was like, how could God let this happen? Not only did he die, he suffered. You know, it was horrible. I stopped going to AA meetings because I just, how could I believe that a higher power, you know, would take care of me and all the things, the promises that it says? You know, how could I believe, you know, why did that happen? I thought, well, I'll just work the program without the God part. And what happened was, it was I'd go to about a meeting a year, and then I would go pick up my check. And I remember going to pick up my check. It was a meeting out past North Lake, and a guy said, "Well, you come here once a year to pick up your check." And so it was like, okay, I'll never come back. And what happened was I just got angrier and angrier and angrier. I mean, I was like insanely angry. I did have a job, and that was a place that I could go, and I had some friends at the job, and that's a place that I could, you know, have kind of a normal existence. And I was able to keep that job. But I'd go home at night, and I wouldn't go out. And then on the weekends, I would just go to bed. And I just stayed in bed. But I didn't drink. But still, as time went by, the anger got so bad that I remember one day I was standing in the grocery store, and there was, you know, it was in the liquor aisle. And I wasn't thinking about drinking, but I'd never worried about the drink that I would think about. I'd always worried about the one that the story about Jim talks about, where you've got this resentment, and then you go to this place, an innocuous place, and you drink in your milk and then think, "Oh, I'll put some whiskey in it." That was the drink I'd always worried about. Yeah, because I'm powerless over alcohol. And so I, it was like it came over me. Unless I find a way back to AA, I'm gonna drink. And I know that I will die. I'm like a really suicidal kind of person. So I did. I came back in here. And there was a little lady named Debbie who was here. And she put her arms around me and let me cry and helped me. And I started coming to meetings. And I was like, it took me a long time to stop being so feral. But I started sponsoring people, and I started getting back to meetings. And it was amazing how I started to change back again. I have the disease of alcoholism. So it's not, my disease is not alcohol, it's alcoholism. And the program is just the perfect fit for me to treat my alcoholism, you know, and to not pick up a drink a day at a time. And so I came to the meetings, and I started to get back involved in AA. And I realized that I must find a way to have, you know, to use the higher power part of the program. I had to. It was like I finally just thought, well, this is the only way I can do it. I've got to believe that, I'm not God, so I'm not running the world. I can't make all this stuff happen. I can't put planets and stars in the sky. I don't have all that power. So who the hell am I to think that I know how the world should be and what's best for the world? So what I did was I just gave up and thought, somewhere it makes sense. Or maybe it doesn't, but I'm going to have to act as if it makes sense somewhere so that I can start having conscious contact with a higher power. The last thing I'm going to say, because we need to close this pretty quickly, but for years and years and years after that, I really, it was like I didn't consciously know it, but I hated myself for surviving my kids. And so I wouldn't let myself be happy or have fun. I could, like, you can do 12-step work, and you can do this, and you can do that, but you can't have any joy in your life. And it wasn't conscious. But one day I started realizing, I hate myself, and hate is a defect of character. If I'm going to work the steps, I'm going to have to do something about this. So I got down on my knees, and I said this prayer. I said, God, I'm not willing to let go of this hate. I hate myself. I think I should hate myself. But I'm willing to be willing to let it go if it's your will. I said, you're going to have to help me because this hate's going to kill me. You're going to have to help me. I got up from that prayer. I said, you know, God, if you don't help me, I'm going to die. I got up from that prayer, and then the most amazing things started to happen. It was like everything that I saw, every place that I looked, some answer, some comfort would come to me. Like I wasn't, you know, I had said, God, if I should be dead, kill me. You know, just do it. But that the opposite happened. Nothing but love came to me. I saw this program on TV. This man had, he trained bears. And he had this trained bear. And his cousin wanted to do this scene. He used them in movies and stuff. And the cousin wanted to do a scene with it. And they did all the protocols and made everything really safe, the ropes and all this stuff. And this cousin got in with the bear. And the bear just turned and like bit his neck and killed him. Just like that. And that man, what he said, I would give anything if that hadn't happened. I would give my life if that hadn't happened. But now I have to live with it. I have to go on. And then I shared about it in this meeting, in one of the 11 o'clock meetings, and people came up to me from the program, and they shared that one person was like, I let my cousin drive drunk and he died and I have to live with it. And another one said, I shot somebody and I have to live with it. And I knew I was not alone. I was not alone. The program, the biggest thing the program's given is that the hole in my gut and my sense of being unable to connect with people, always this gnawing hole, and it lasted a long time into sobriety. But that hole is finally gone. I don't have it anymore. I finally found peace. And like I said, I still have to work the program. I still have to do the steps. I still have to go to meetings. But I'm at peace for the first time in my life. And for that, I'm truly grateful. Thank you to everyone who's listened, being so nice. I think that's all I have to say. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm Tim. I'm alcoholic. One of the things the big book tells us is if we do what she said, we'll be reasonably happy and usefully whole. Donna gave me that. She actually developed the website for AABlueChipSpeakers.org. You may not be aware of it, but we've got a little over 700 recordings online where people can freely download them and listen to it. And it wouldn't have ever been possible had it been for Donna.
I love this program. It's so awesome. Mo's here. Just we got everything going tonight.
Thank you.
I've asked Annie to come and pass out the chairs.
My name is Annie. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic in Annie. And Donna, that was a great story. I never heard it, but it was good. It was good. I'm glad I came. We have, in this Blue Chip Speakers meeting, we have a white chip. And it's known for people that want to start a new way of life. And he takes
it. All right, come on.
Sunday morning. No one else around. I was coming to, 'cause you were coming to town. Forever in our hearts.